Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Neva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, coming to you from a glorious Vancouver morning where we're getting into the doldrums of winter and a very, very rainy March. But I have the great opportunity today to speak with Emily Green, who is Director of Student and Faculty Development and Assistant Professor of Medical Science at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University, which most of you will know as a very prestigious institution on the east coast of the U.S. She and her colleague, Philip Griposo, have a paper entitled Justice and Care, Decision-Making by Medical School Student Promotion Committees, coming out in the June 2017 issue of Medical Education. Emily, I'm very grateful to have the chance to chat with you about your paper.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. It's an interesting and unique focus, as you note in your article, and learning that your title is Director of both Student and Faculty Development gives me some early suspicions, anyway, as to why turning the lens on the promotions committees might have been something important and of interest to you. But can I ask you to put in your own words, what is that office and how did it come to be that you were put in charge of Director of both Student and Faculty Development?
Sure. It is a dual role that probably doesn't exist in other institutions. I spend about half of my time in direct advising of medical students, helping them with academic issues, personal issues, some career issues as well. And then in recent years, actually developed the central source for educational faculty development at the medical school. So we really work on how to help faculty be better educators. And it is true that the sort of promotions committee focus represents that intersection between those two roles.
Yeah, and I imagine has the potential anyway to create some conflict of interest or at least some tensions as you try to think through how to best support both students and faculty. What does the promotion committee look like in your context? Is there clarity with respect to the mandate for that group?
Yeah, there is. And I think, like a lot of institutions, student affairs folks usually play an advisory role within those promotions committees. So they are the source of a lot of information about students. We share the kinds of information perhaps that doesn't appear on transcripts, but that help give some context to student performance. But we are not voting members. So that is, in fact, my role. I am an ex officio member, so I don't vote on student cases, but provide a little bit of context when students are struggling.
Right. Okay. Again, for the sake of anybody working in locations where they don't have this sort of process, this is a group that reviews every student's file after every assessment moment, or what's your normal workflow?
Right. So that can, I think, vary quite a bit by institution, whether or not they meet, as you said, after every assessment point or at some kind of regular basis per semester. I think that can change by institution. But yes, our basic charge is to monitor student performance over time, to make recommendations about promoting students from one year to the next, dismissing students in extreme cases, but moving them along that kind of academic standing continuum. And in addition, here at Brown, the charge also includes professionalism. So I know at some medical education institutions, violations of professional codes of conduct are dealt with by separate committees. At Brown, we really use the same committee structure to deal with academic struggles as well as issues of professionalism.
That actually leads nicely, I think, to the theoretical framing. You mentioned early in your paper that there's contrasting ethics of justice and care. What does that mean, and why was it so central that it actually became the opening words of your title?
Yeah, so that really became the theoretical framework for our study, and it really reflects, I think, a central tension that'll be familiar to anybody who's served on one of these kinds of committees, which is, I think, the desire to support students, to validate our relationships with those students, to make sure that they have the appropriate opportunity for remediation and growth and development, and to really respond to a lot of the complexity that students bring to the table. So, you know, they're coming to that committee often with very complex personal lives or situations or circumstances that have impacted their ability to function as a student. And so the ethic of care really represents that desire to prioritize student support and responsiveness to them. And then the ethic of justice really kind of represents, in some ways, its opposite, but one thing that, you know, we sort of found in the study that it's not actually its opposite, is more the focus on policy implementation, consistency, objectivity when reviewing student cases. And I think that theoretical framework really reflects a tension between those two kind of ethical orientations.
And was that a tension that you were seeing individuals struggle with, or seeing as conflict between different members of these committees? I'm just curious as to if there was some set of experiences that led you to believe this was a high priority area for us to better understand.
I do think it is. It's really intense work. Again, you know, there's probably a small number of faculty at any given institution who's worked directly on these committees, but I think the people who do are really passionate about it, and part of that is that the work is fairly intense, because while on the surface it would seem to perhaps be, you know, a black and white application of certain rules or policies, but in practice, when you get into the meat of student cases, or when students come themselves and appear before the committee, you do get a lot of somewhat competing priorities that are really reflected in this framework of justice and care. So, you know, definitely have seen folks struggle with the decisions that need to get made. It's a really high-stakes environment, so we have students who are investing a huge amount of money, a huge amount of time, not to mention a lot of their personal dreams and aspirations, into being a physician, and sometimes those dreams and aspirations are kind of coming up against a promotions committee who is uncertain that they are going to be successful, or who the committee is asking them to stop, or telling them that they must stop. And so I think it just ends up being some fairly intense work that can create a lot of ethical dilemmas for committee members.
Mm-hmm. And you chose to go about exploring those dilemmas by using a survey methodology that looks like it went around to the entirety of the country and people working on these sorts of committees. What was the core research question that you were hoping to address with that survey?
Yeah, we had three main goals, and, you know, in part the choice of a survey may seem a little bit antithetical to what I just said, that, you know, personal intense experience, but the fact of the matter is there's almost nothing out there. So when I first started to do my literature reviews, it was very hard to kind of even get a basis, you know, on which to start some real scholarly work, because there's very little out there that's been done in this area. So to a certain extent, part of what I wanted to do is just create a baseline of information from across multiple institutions. So we did send out the survey to 143 allopathic med schools in the U.S. and ended up with 241 participants across 55 institutions. And we had three main goals. So one was to really see what those voting members' perceptions of the committee and the committee's role were. We wanted to think more about where people came down on that ethic of care versus ethic of justice framework. And then third, we really wanted to find out what particular student characteristics and circumstances were most influential to their personal decision making. And the survey really does deal with personal decision making, knowing that that is just the first step for what ends up being a lot of times a very complex group decision making. But again, this was really kind of step one in what I hope is some more robust studies down the line.
I'm going to focus my next question on the second goal that you just stated, both because I think it yielded some of the particularly interesting data, but also you just alluded to some of those results a minute ago when you said that the contrast between justice and care wasn't maybe as great as you anticipated going in. What did you mean by that? What was in your data that gave you that impression that these things might not conflict as much as they could?
So it turns out that participants really didn't view an ethic of care and an ethic of justice as being mutually exclusive. So, for example, in their personal decision making, they indicated that it was important for them to be humanistic and empathetic, both of which are elements of an ethic of care, but also objective and fair, which are both elements of an ethic of justice, and that they really wanted to be able to operate from both of these ethical orientations at the same time. And so that was really one of the major results of our study, is that these things were not perceived as mutually exclusive. So that kind of raises the question of, you know, in a given situation then, from which ethical orientation is a person going to operate at that given time? And that's really something that we don't know yet.
Right, and it suggests the importance of remaining somewhat agile in these committees and being light on one's feet, whereas the danger for some of these things can be there are so many students in some of our classes that it's easy to fall into that factory or cookie cutter mold.
Absolutely.
To get any indication as to how people maintain that flexibility or if they're able to, given the ideals that were expressed?
Well, I mean, so we did look at a number of different elements. So if ethical orientation is not a one or the other orientation and people are more flexible, then it basically perhaps is more a function of what is your role, you know. And so we looked at, do student members of committees make decisions differently than administrators or faculty? And it turns out that on some respects that's actually true. We did look at gender to see whether gender is a factor, and we had some interesting results there. I think probably the thing that is most interesting is the importance of the student narrative and what are the, you know, particular elements or characteristics of students that influence whether a faculty member in that particular decision-making setting operates from that ethic of care or from that ethic of justice, both of which they may really hold dear. And so is it the contextual details of that student's story that kind of sways them in one direction or the other?
And do they provide any indication as to what they've found valuable in enabling them to deal with what's appropriate and what's not when they're dealing with those individual students and trying to take their situation into account? Or given that your respondents indicated that they typically didn't have formal training, how do they come to learn to deal with these challenges?
Yeah, I mean, I think the lack of formal training is one of, I think, the things that I was most surprised by. I mean, 85% of our respondents indicated that they had no training. And the ones who did, it was really limited to what are the committee rules or bylaws, but not really about what you just alluded to, more of a values-based, this is what we hold dear, this is how we want to treat students, this is the kind of physician that we want to produce. These are what we think is really important when it comes to protecting those students' future patients. And that kind of values-based training, I think, is sorely lacking.
And that leads me to a question I think we'll use to wrap up, which is, given your role that we started talking about at the beginning of this conversation of both student and faculty development, what does this effort change for you in terms of how you're trying to support the promotion committees that you work with locally?
Yeah. So one thing that we're actually currently working on is an article designed to give appropriate tips to those folks out there, either in new medical schools or for existing schools that are trying to kind of revamp their committee process. Perhaps they've even had some legal challenges which have made them realize that they need to better develop concrete protocols and bylaws, some tips that they could follow to do this better. And again, these are not a one-size-fits-all assignment. This is much more about how do you create a committee that works for your students, for your faculty, with your institutional values, but how could a committee actually come to really some good conclusions about those values and have those values guide their work? So that's really, I think, the next horizon when it comes to this, is creating some helpful guidelines for how to do this better.
And being deliberate and sensitive to the context and all those other things.
Absolutely.
that sound like it was good advice within the committee as well as for the development of these systems.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. Congratulations. Again, there aren't a lot of areas of focus that one can claim so little previous work on in health professional education these days. So this definitely seems like a unique and very important contribution. So I wish you the best of luck in continuing its development.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I continue to find it fascinating.
Yeah, I bet. For those who want more details, I'll just remind them that I've been speaking with Emily Green about a paper entitled Justice and Care, Decision-Making by Medical School Student Promotions Committees that you will find in the June 2017 issue of Medical Education. Thanks, Emily, and hope that summer treats you well.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.